Have begun. If you do have any objections, you may disconnect at this time.
Thank you very much. Alan, would you like me to do a quick roll call?
Sure.
On the call today, we have Michael Palage, Barry Cobb, Alan Greenberg, James Waddell, and for staff, we have Marjorie Mylan and myself, Marika Koning.
So we managed to get everyone at a new time.
That's no small feat.
Thanks again, everybody.
Once the recording's over, we want the story of what happened. but I don't think we need to preserve this for the ICANN archives. I would suggest that we use as the starting list the list of questions that Michael sent out. I received it on the 10th of August at 22:42 p.m. Eastern time. That would have been on the 11th of August at 2:42 in the morning, UTC. Does everyone have access to that list now, or can we get it out quickly?
I can forward it to.
Sorry, I didn't understand that.
Does everybody have it, or I could send it to the group real quick? And if people don't have,
does anyone not have it?
It's just very unsearchable through my email, but I'll get it.
The subject was additional fact-finding. Started with that on the Pedner mailing list.
I just sent it out again, the list, real quick. So,
okay, I would suggest we use this as the starting point for discussion, and then modify it, add, delete as necessary as we go along. Okay, to kick it off, the first question on the list was, what is registrar's practice regarding domain name at the time of expiration when the registrant gives explicit instructions regarding its intention not to renew, and then goes on with some specific things. My question on that one is, do we care? Because we're talking about a situation where the registrant has indicated through some positive way that they are not interested in continuing. I would say it doesn't fall under the auspices of our scope. Any comments?
This is James.
Yep.
Alan, I would tend to agree on the surface that you're correct. However, I would point out that Christina Rosette posted a comment on the PEDNR comment forum right now that is pointed exactly at this question.
Okay.
Relative to cease and desist and possible UDRP versus a domain name that was, canceled or abandoned by the registrant. I'm fine with it either way if we decide that it's not germane to our topic. In fact, I think the first comment or paragraph of her comment was that she had some difficulty trying to squeeze it into one of our charter questions.
Was that sent out just recently?
In the last 24 hours, Alan. Yes.
Yeah, last 24 hours, yeah. Mike, you know what I'm talking about, that comment there?
Yeah, exactly. I was actually talking with Christina yesterday, and I actually encouraged her to submit it because, again, what I was trying to get here at is, from what she told me, she did not give me the particular name of the registrar. She just said, I believe it was an affiliate of a top 15 registrar is the only information that she gave me. But I think, I wrote this question, almost a month ago. But I do think it was rather interesting to see what some people in the marketplace do that potentially impact, a post-expiration scenario. Because
okay, I don't seem to have received that message, so can you summarize again what the scenario is?
It is on the public comment forum.
Okay. Oh, on the comment forum. Okay, I see. Okay. Let me see if I can get to that quickly then. Go ahead, Michael.
As I said, instead of me trying to summarize it, it will take 2 minutes for you to read it, so probably better to have it straight from Christina's mouth than me to perhaps mess up the fact pattern.
I need to get to it because I wasn't on that wiki page.
Yeah, and you know, my position being that you know, whether we seek that out or not, I think the question number one on Mike's list and Ms. Rosette's comments are fairly closely aligned.
This is Marika. If I can add something,
yes,
as
please.
Well, I did recently get an attorney a question, because apparently there was as well a question from a registrar who explicitly had asked a registrar to delete their domain name registration, and that was as well the question, like, if a registrar specifically asked for it to be deleted, should it be the case? And I think under the current rules, that's not the case. It depends on the deletion policy of a registrar. That's an issue as well, where registrars might have different practices. In certain cases, they might be able to delete the name if they specifically request so. And then others, I quickly looked at some registrar agreement, and some say after you can only delete it in, of course, the first and the AGP, but after that you cannot delete the domain name anymore.
Well, and this is James. I'd love to comment on that.
Go ahead.
If there's a queue or okay.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that that's true, Marika, absolutely. You know, there's a theory and then there's a practice. And in practice, what we found is that with our, you know, volume of transactions, if someone requests that we delete a domain name, the odds are, you know, 10 to 20% that a few days later they may want to reverse that. And, you know, the deleting of a domain name is for many purposes, is an irreversible action. You actually have to go and hope that you can re-register it again. So we leave it undeleted for a period of about, I believe it's 30 days.
Okay, so what
you're... Just to confirm that they're, you know, serious. and to give the registrant an opportunity to undo that transaction.
Okay, so really what you're saying is just because someone says, I don't intend to, in enough cases they change their mind, therefore we do have to consider that scenario.
Yeah, in enough cases, you know, let's say it's 10% of cases. Well, now we're talking, you know, possibly tens of thousands a month, right?
Yeah. So. Okay, then I withdraw my original comment, and the concept of what you do in this scenario stays on the board. Now, of course, if they actually delete the name, then it goes into the redemption grace period. But the question is, what happens if some other scenario is followed?
And this, Rick, if I can just add, because I think the scenario I was talking about is maybe even a little bit different, and I don't know if it fits anywhere here or if it belongs in some of the questions we come to later, because, of course, that's at the time, you know, they don't give explicit instructions not to renew, but they basically give instructions to delete. So, you know, if it's a different scenario, but I presume, you know, my understanding of the rules that currently are, if a registrant has signed the agreement in which the deletion and renewal policies are outlined, and it says that a domain name, you know, after it is not renewed, or that it goes first to auto renewal, and in that case it can, you know, be transferred or sold or auctioned to a third party, that's the rules under which the registrant needs to operate.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if I understand that correctly, but I am speaking specifically of a registrant has specifically asked us to delete or cancel the registration prior to its expiration date.
Yes, but a cancellation and a deletion is different. I mean, the deletion, I interpreted as someone wants it to go to RGP and just skip the auto-renewal phase.
Okay. That is slightly different, but... For practical purposes, you know, because we would be overwhelmed by unhappy customers wanting to undo that later, we just hold it and let it cool off for a period of 30 days to ensure that they're not going to call back and ask us to undo
okay,
that.
But you're talking about a request to delete prior to expiration.
Yes.
Okay. So we have that scenario, which may or may not fall under our domain, because we are looking specifically at post-expiration issues.
Then understood, but this is part of question one and also part of the comment from Christina.
I understand, but I'm trying to separate out the various flavors of this.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the option of what happens on a request for a deletion prior to expiration.
Right.
Then we have the option which Michael specifically referred to in the question here of the registrant gives notice not to renew, that they are not interested in renewing.
So that's the effect of removing the auto-renew setting and setting it to manually renew and then choosing not to.
Well, what do you mean by the auto-renew setting?
Registrations have a flag that says essentially that they will automatically renew.
Well, that's a flag between the registrar and registree.
We extend that control to the registrar.
Okay. Well, you may not. Everyone certainly does.
Right. Right.
And in any case, you may not renew with the registrant, but you may renew with the registree and do something else with it under the contractual terms.
Not if it's an auto renew and it renews automatically, regardless of what we do. But go ahead.
But James, what happens is, this is Mike, is, and I think this is the point I'm trying to get at. If the client says, I don't want it, and there could be a couple of different reasons. Again, not unlike the scenario that Christine had mentioned, someone could find themselves potentially subject to a UDRP or a legal claim, and they're like, oh, I didn't know about it. Basically it's a hot potato. Get it away. I don't want to be involved with it anymore. You know, so whether that happens in the midterm or at the end of the registration, and again, not to sound like a broken record, but I think what we're looking for is predictability here. What expectations should a registrant be entitled to rely upon? And if a client says, I don't want it, if a registrar says, well, I know better, and I'm going to renew it, and then I may try to sell it or do something, I mean, I think that really goes towards the intent of, you know, when a customer says, this is what I want to have happen, and then a registrar does something different, that begins to then open up a series of other questions of, well, why is the registrar doing this, and is it for the benefit of the registrant, or is it for its own self financial interest?
Okay.
And that's why I want these questions to be asked.
Yeah. Okay, Mike, but let me just address that. You know, we speak in these anecdotes in terms of singular individuals, and then when we look at these things in the aggregate of thousands or millions of people conducting these operations, some of them truly want the registrar to follow those instructions immediately and without delay, and some want to come back a couple of days later and want the option to undo that request. Okay?
And put it this way, James, if that customer, right, so again, I say I don't want Pelage.com, right?
Uh-huh.
I wake up, I don't want it, and I say delete it. Now, if in fact my original request is carried out where it's deleted, the redemption grace period would kick in, and I, when I had a change of heart, right, you would then come to me as my registrar of choice and say, well, Mr. Pelage, you changed your mind. We appreciate that, but it's now going to cost you $40, the registry fee for the redemption grace period, and whatever your markup is, which I believe is $80. So,
well,
again,
it's $80 total, but go ahead.
Okay.
Okay, so it's $80. Yeah. Excellent. So $80 total. So the person who makes the mistake, the redemption grace period is still there to protect them. It's still there to protect them. It's not like they wake up 7 days later and they can't get their name back. They can get it back. There'll just be consequences associated with executing that particular request.
Mike, can I try to take control back of this meeting?
Sure.
Okay. What I think we need to do is the reason I raised the issue of the midterm request to delete is I want to make sure that no one will come back and say, this is mission creep, this was not within the scope of the PDP. I'm not saying it isn't an interesting scenario that someone should be looking at. I have a strong question on whether it is within the scope of the PDP. So let's take that one, separate that one for the moment. And with regard to the events that happen at or around expiration, I think what you're asking is quite reasonable. I would propose that the form of the question be as much as possible in sort of yes-no answers, although I think we're going to have to ask a registrar what is the sequence of events that happen. But we want to try to minimize the effort involved to answer these questions and particularly to try to analyze it after the fact. Does that make sense?
Marika, because my question is indeed, because I think we spoke before about, you know, doing a kind of survey and like making it anonymous or not obvious who we're looking at. But of course, if you're asking these kind of questions, I guess you would end up giving sections of the specific policies or agreements that spell out what happens in that scenario. So I agree, if it would be more yes-no questions, of course, that would make it a lot easier to anonymize and, you know, compare than, you know, having this kind of information probably is interesting as well, but, you know, it might not be as easy to compare or anonymize the data.
Yeah. I mean, there are a number of things that we need yes-no, either yes-no answers to or time frame answers to. You know, does the domain, you know, when does the domain stop resolving in the original, you know, to the original website in particular? When who is information changed? And you know, I think we can easily come up with a number of other things, you know, during which periods, and this is not a yes-no answer, but during which periods can the registrant get the name back? So I think we have a number of specific questions we can ask which either have simple yes-no answers or quantitative answers. I'm not sure that will cover the whole sequence of understanding the timeline of what happens at expiration. But I would think that to start with, we should try to do something like that to minimize the effort involved in collecting this data and analyzing it. Do we have agreement, or is what I'm saying stupid?
This is Barry.
Yeah.
You know, it seems to me what I'm a process guy. You know, I think of start here, end here, and in between is some sort of process.
Mm-hmm.
And within that process, and you will, you have transactions. So for every transaction that traverses that process, You get, you know, a specific outcome. And what I think we probably, you know, I feel like we're almost kind of cart before the horse, because some of these questions boil down to yes and no answers. Given the complexity of this process, I don't think we're going to get all the results that we want. So, you know, and this is merely just a suggestion from work that I've done in completely different industry, but what we really try to do is try to write down on paper exactly what that process looks like. In case of this example is the world of domain expirations, you know, and we would look at kind of prior to expiration and what that looks like, what happens at expiration, what happens at post-expiration. And I think we've got a high-level model started. That's the diagram that's been floating around that shows when the RGP and all of that stuff kicks in. But what we're really wanting to do is dive down to the deeper layer to understand all of the variables in those types of transactions. So, for instance, you know, I kind of like using the 80-20 rule. 80% of the registrars probably out there have very similar processes on how they handle expired domains, regardless of the scenario, whether I ask for it to be deleted first, but prior to expiration, or I let it expire and it deletes, et cetera. And then you have the other 20% that have all of these different variables. They either don't honor the RGP and delete it right away, et cetera. So my recommendation here is that I almost think that we need to find a lot of smart people in addition to what we have on here, and let's try to map out on paper what the exact process looks like. Then from there, we can kind of create the use cases that help us determine what that 80-20 rule is going to look like.
And then from there, we can really start to formulate, okay, what questions do we really need to ask some of these registrars that we don't have mapped out right now, and then look at starting to send out either a survey or something. But I'm concerned. I'll just stop there.
Yeah. I think one of your premises is incorrect in that I don't think we can find 80% of the registrars who follow the same process. Just talking to two or three very large registrars, I have found quite different processes that they follow.
Okay, forgive my 80% number, but you know, at least start to formulate that this cluster of the top tier registrars kind of go down this path, or you know, whatever those numbers look like.
So you're suggesting we not try to outline specific questions, but assign someone to try to understand the process in each registrar or in a group of large registrars and try to somehow map out how they're similar and how they're different.
Yes, I mean, the way I'm interpreting this is we're wanting to get a picture of what current state looks like out there. And for me, being a process guy, and when I hear the transparency and predictability and everything like that, especially from a process guy, I would expect to see that. The fact that there is all of these variances post-expiration, to me, is very confusing from a registrant perspective, especially when I'm trying to navigate the market.
And that's exactly the problem that we're trying to address.
So, you know, I think in terms of the purposes of this sub-team is we're really trying to understand what current state is. And the way that I do that in my other world is I get all the smart people I can into one room and we hash it out over X number of days until we're all satisfied that, you know, you've got your start over here, your end over here, and here's all of the decisions and the tasks or occurrences, things that go on in that process that satisfy all of the variances of types of transactions that go on out there. When we've got that picture of current state, then we can only then begin to formulate what desired state should look like or come up with the recommendations that we think we should change, whether they're even worthy of changes. To James's point, you know, if some of these things that we should change go on out in the marketplace, but they have it happen at such a small scale, then is it really worth the effort to either A, formalize through the PDP, or B, for registrars to sign up for it because it's such an insignificant.
Okay, but I think you're getting ahead of the game right now. We're not at the stage where we're trying to decide what to do, but just to understand what's going on right now.
I'm all about current state.
Marika and Margie, do you have any comments on what was just proposed?
This is Marika. I mean, as I said before, of course, to carry out the survey, having very clear questions will help, and you know, I do agree with Barry that I think it would be helpful to have a very clear understanding of the process and where we feel we need specific information. And I think in some of the areas, it depends as well. I mean, the 80-20 discussion that you were having, it depends, I guess, on which element you're looking at. If you look at, you know, which registrars give registrants opportunities to get their name back after expiration, well, I think that's 80% or more than 80%, but how that is done, that might be very different, and there might be where the nuances are. So I think it might make sense to drill deeper on some of those issues. And maybe it comes together as well with, as we discussed on the call on Tuesday, that we need to write up that whole process, and that might be as well a starting point to find those gaps.
Yeah, I guess my feeling is we do understand the overall process, but we don't understand the differences in how the situation is treated at each time point by the registrars.
I agree, Alan. And going back to Barry, he's talking about the variance, right? So we have the kind of big picture, but it's the variance that we want to look at, because that goes back to what the registrant is experiencing in the marketplace. So again, that was the original intent. And, you know, again, I'll respect some of the price points. We can take them out. But some of the first groups of questions, maybe the first, first seven questions that I was trying to ask here, was to throw out a net to take different snapshots of what's happening here, so that staff would be able to identify trends in different variant practices between registrars, whether that's 80-20 or whatever. They would be able to give us a broad brushstroke of what's happening that would then allow us to do some finer, if you will, some refinement questions, or perhaps begin to, you know, deep dive into another particular area.
Yeah.
That was my approach.
I'm concerned, though, if we put together questions or a request for information which can't be answered over the phone or in a relatively simple way, and if we're asking a registrar to come up with essentially a process diagram of how they treat the whole renewal process, I think we're not going to get very good
negative
participation,
I'm
and certainly not quick.
This is Barry.
But Alan, that's exactly...
That.
Okay, one at a time. Michael first and Barry.
Yeah, I can let Barry go, please.
I was going to say, I'm not asking that we have a registrar fill this out. You know, this needs to be within the team. We create all of the material needed for that. And, you know, instead of a survey, I would, like I said in my other life or my other job, I actually get those SMEs, the subject matter experts, into a room and we interview them. So it you know, instead of a survey that's kind of a wide blanket in the audience out there, we need to find people like the Jameses out there, either through the registrar constituency or the like, that we can sit down with and say, all right, here's what we have right now, poke holes in it, here's the process, do you follow it or not, where is your variance, and try to poke that out without trying to glean proprietary information. I mean, I know that we want to protect that realm, you know, from our findings. So,
yeah.
Again, to answer your point, the work needs to be done here, and then however we approach the registrars, we're armed with the info, not just a bunch of questions or a blank page, and show us how you do it.
Alan, can I be in the queue?
Sure, yes, please.
James.
Yeah, and then James. Marika first.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to say, because looking at some of the questions, I mean, the requirement under the EDDP is that registrars need to post the renewal and deletion policies as well as fees associated with RGP. So I think a lot of information that is being asked here should be relatively easy to access through either a registrant agreement or specific policies that are posted on the website. And this is information that the registrants should have access to as well, you know, when they decide which registrar they want to sign up with.
That's
my assumption, at least.
I guess I don't quite agree. Most registrant contracts now include a term saying the registrar at its sole decision may transfer the domain, using a variety of words, but effectively transfer the domain to someone else. But it rarely specifies when that happens, is it revocable, is it changeable, or and what the prices are associated with getting it back before and after that period. So I don't think we're going to find a lot of this on their websites. I mean, we'll certainly find some answers on the websites, but the really critical ones of what happens in the few weeks following expiration, I don't
think. Would it make sense then indeed to find first the information that's actually there so we can actually identify which are, you know, the big questions or answers that are really missing? Because, I've looked at, doing the issues report, I've looked at numerous sites and looked at the different policies, and some do explain in quite some detail what happens, and you know, another questions about what happens with the sharing of profits and when can the registrant get their name back at any, you know, what point and what does he need to do. Or so some do describe it, and you know, I'm sure some might not do it, but you know, it might be a starting point, that information that is publicly available. And And as I said, I think, you know, we have James on the call here, and I think there are a number of other registrars that are part of this group that might be able to help them as well to identify those questions, you know, where we can find the information to.
I guess I'm not clear on what the steps are that happened going out of this meeting to start the data collection process, because where we are in the PDP is we continually come back to until we have some data of what's going on, both in terms of problems for the registrant, and simply in terms of what the reality is, we're not going to be in a position to discuss anything further. So I think you're suggesting go back to the data you've already collected, do some more data, talk to the few of the registrars who will talk to us at this point, and try to assemble some sort of picture. Did I capture that reasonably?
Yeah, based on the questions I think that Mike has put together to see, you know, what information we can find like that, and for which questions do we need to go back and, you know, call people or try to, you know, work with those that are participating in this group to find information that, you know, is not publicly available.
Okay. Let's assume for the moment that that's how we'll proceed, and I'd like to continue down the list and see if the following questions are ones that are indeed ones we agree need to be looked at, and how they might be modified.
Alan, this is James. Am I still in the queue?
I'm sorry. Did I miss you? Yes, certainly.
Yeah, so, you know, just trying to take all of this in here a little bit, and, you know, and maybe we can just go ahead and go on down the list of questions, but I wanted to point out that, you know, we're talking about essentially differences of service level, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And some registrars may have a very well-documented and well-defined process to take care of their customers, perhaps at greater expense to themselves, and I'm mentioning GoDaddy here, you know, because we feel that, you know, based on our experience in managing our customers, that is what helps to make them happy. Other registrars may not even have a written process, or it may vary depending, you know, day-to-day or depending on who answered the phone at that given time. So I think that I'm leery of any comparison or data gathering that says, that starts off from an assumption of this process, this method that we've described here in the group with our subject matter experts is the correct one. How do you deviate from it? You know, and instead approach it as, you know, registrars know their customers better than we do. I don't know Network Solutions customers or Enom's customers or Tucows customers, and I would assume they don't know ours. So we've developed processes that are tailored to, you know, to ensure that they are satisfied. And I think that any approach that says that, you know, there should be some one-size-fits-all type of service model, it's starting to tread into some dangerous area, in my opinion. So, but we can go down the list if you'd like to continue.
Well, I guess one of the issues is, let's assume we come up with a registrar whose official policy is that the microsecond that it expires, we take it and we transfer it to somebody else, and there's no way the registrant can get it back. I don't know if there's such a registrar. It doesn't really matter.
Okay, so the hypothetical
registrar, you know,
that's
perhaps the worst case possible. Okay?
Actually, Alan, perhaps the worst case possible is the scenario that was kind of outlined by Christina, where the customer doesn't have it in their account, who is still associated with it, and that registrar may be allocating or doing something with it. I mean, that's probably the most.
I don't want to debate what the worst case is.
Okay.
The question is, out of this PDP, we can decide to leave sleeping dogs lie. Whatever is happening is happening, and we're not going to attempt to take any action. We can require that a registrar make their intents and make their practices known in a very clear way. Or we can say that is not acceptable. A registrant must have at least 15 days under which they can get it back, even if the price is outrageous. I'm just giving an example of a range of possible outcomes. Now, I don't think we're predicting at this point what outcome we're trying to do, but the question is, how do we get an idea of what's going on now to decide whether we need to take any action or not? And I think that's the questions we're asking right now. We're not trying to flag good or bad or ask how registrars deviate from some norm. We're trying to
But at some point, you're going to have to make the determination, for example, that 15 days is adequate time and 14 days is not.
Yes,
right?
We will.
At some point, we're going to have to cut that off and say, One or the other.
And that's why they pay us the big bucks to sit on a policy formulating working group.
The registrant who complains because they needed 16 days is still going to be out there. So I'm just, from practical terms.
Of course. The registrant who says, I didn't realize it expired 3 years ago, I want it back, is still going to be out there. And we're not going to do anything for them, I think.
and I think, Alan, that's right. I mean, what we talk about is we talk about the ICANN bottom-up consensus-building process. And what we're trying to do is find consensus on what is that reasonable minimum level of expectation that we're going to provide registrants. And then above that level, registrars can distinguish themselves in the marketplace, provided that they provide that level of safety.
Okay, do we...
Well, I'm concerned that once you establish some minimum baselines that everyone will gravitate toward that, Mike. This is kind of my business.
Well, and if that happens, if the market allows that to happen, so it does. We can't change the world.
The only thing I would say, James, is, and again, I say this within the context of, you know, just having reread the Ninth Circuit opinion in the CFIT case, ICANN is a standard-setting body, and generally speaking, standard-setting bodies that operate in accordance with their, their mandate are generally protected. Courts provide a deference to standard-setting bodies. So I think that's what we just need to do. Stick to the bottom-up consensus mandate. We're looking at protecting registrants. Let's do that. And I think, if we run afoul, ICANN General Counsel would probably do their job and let us know when we're treading on some landmines.
I think we can pretty well guarantee that.
Okay, well, let's move on to the next question, Al.
Okay. The second question was essentially the same question, but assuming the registrant does not give notice that they plan to discard. So essentially it's the silent registrant.
Okay, so one would be, Mrs. James, so one would be an active cancellation or deletion, request for deletion, and then the second one would be more of a passive abandonment of the registration?
That's correct. Because I presume the other alternative is a conscious statement saying I want to renew, and we're presuming at that point it's renewed and it's no longer an expiration issue.
And James, GoDaddy's practice, in my understanding as a customer of GoDaddy, is you're looking to protect my interest, so in case I've made a mistake, either intentionally or unintentionally, you're going to renew in both Scenario 1 and Scenario 2.
In Scenario 1 and Scenario 2, probably, yes, depending on the TLD.
Yep.
And considering that the only TLD that we carry that doesn't do that is, I believe you're correct.
Well, we already established yesterday that the practice doesn't generally vary based on what the TLD auto-renew policy is.
Right. We don't make a differentiation just for one.
Okay. Question number 3 is, does the registrar affirmatively change any of the underlying WHOIS data in or around the time of expiration? That's a yes-no question. I would have thought we need to ask it in the form of, do you change the data other than at the explicit request of the registrant, and if so, when? I think it's the same question, but we get more information out of it.
Alan, this is James. I prefer the way it's worded now. I think it's much more concise. I think you're going to have more of a spectrum of responses with the other question. I think, maybe going after a wider swath of information, it's also going to be difficult to compare the responses.
True, but it has a very substantive impact in that, in theory, a registrant can change registrars post-expiration, but if WHOIS has been changed, de facto they cannot. So it has a very significant impact on the process. if the information is changed at microsecond one to if it's changed at day 15.
Then I would recommend breaking that into a separate question.
Okay.
I'm just trying to keep it as concise as
possible.
Yeah,
no, I understand. So if the answer is yes, then we can ask when.
Yeah.
That's fine with me. Does the registrar of record have a contractual term in the original registration agreement regarding the treatment of a domain name registration service contract at the time of expiration? Michael, can you explain what you meant by that?
We're on question number
four.
Well, what I was looking for was something along the lines of what James provided me on what I, as a GoDaddy customer, should expect to happen. I think it was day 13, and then I had until day 13, and then after day 13, it then I think went out to potential auction, but then I was still able to recover it. I forget the exact steps, but the link that James provided to me provided me, GoDaddy's customer, a degree of predictability as to what was going to happen at different stages.
Isn't that
helpful.
Isn't that question number two, though? In four, you're specifically saying, are there contractual terms as opposed to what is your practice?
Correct, because, and that goes to, is it hard-coded into the contract, or is this just something that appears on the website that could be changed willy-nilly? So, I did not look at the GoDaddy service
generally
contract.
Generally, contractual terms can be changed without...
Potentially as well, but...
No.
You know, there's a difference between something being in a service terms of contract that generally are sort of, effective dates, they're kind of sequentially tracked as opposed to websites that could, change a lot more drastically.
This is Marika.
Marika.
I have a question on that, because indeed, agreements refer basically to policies that are posted on the site. So in your view, that wouldn't qualify then as a yes under this question. And in addition to that, my other question is, because the EDDP does prescribe if there are any material changes to the renewal and deletion policy that a registrar should be notified. So I don't know whether that then, makes why just a policy post on the web should be less than in the contract written in.
That your last comment is interesting, because most of the agreements I've seen say any of the terms in the agreement can be changed without notice. I wonder if that indeed is in violation of the EDDP also.
I don't know. I'm not a lawyer.
Nor am I.
and again, Alan, the way there perhaps is some overlap with these questions, but again, what I was trying to do was to throw the broadest possible net possible to get this initial, picture of what's going on within the industry. To go back to the questions of finding out what those variants are.
Okay. I think we're going to need to come back to this one after we phrase the first ones properly or satisfactorily to us. Yes, go ahead.
Just going back to question three, as a non-lawyer and non-native English speaker, I'm just wondering, what does the term affirmatively mean here? What are you trying to say with that? Does a registrar need to confirm it with someone, or what does it mean in this context?
I ignored the word because I didn't understand it, Michael.
Maybe actively. That's how I read it.
Well, doesn't the registrar always
actively
have to?
What I was looking at was sort of, I was looking for, I think Rob Hall's presentation talked in Sydney talked about how some of the data was changed. So is that just merely a pending in front of the registrant, pending delete? Or did they, instead of, you know, supplementing information, tagging the existing WHOIS data as this is a pending delete name, or did it go into a holding account of a registrar, or did it go into someone else's account? Again, the use of the word affirmatively perhaps is potentially a little confusing. I think the reason I did that was I did not want a scenario where a registrar would say, yes, the WHOIS changed, i.e., because a year was added onto the domain name term as a result of the auto renew. I was looking for something where the not a change in the WHOIS as a result of a registry auto renew, but the registrar itself changing some of the underlying WHOIS data.
Michael, the way I read that, not understanding the word affirmatively, is you were asking does the registrar change the ownership information, taking ownership in quotes, with unilaterally without having been requested to do that by the original registrant, by the RAE.
I could accept that interpretation. Again, I'm not going to wordsmith this, whatever. And again, Marika, I will defer to you on this as to what is the best plain English to get the most proper response.
No, but we're trying to understand what you meant. And I think you were referring to the information about whose registration is it, not necessarily the peripheral information like the date or a whole.
It would be substantial changes, basically, I guess you're asking.
Yes.
Substantial changes, and I guess that doesn't count like, yes, it's, you know, has expired or things like that.
I mean,
that's, yes.
A registration that is renewed, the information changes, the year gets changed. But
exactly, and I was trying to differentiate.
We're not looking at those.
Okay.
I think we understand. Four, I would suggest that we revisit after we have some better wording for the first ones.
And I just wanted to point out that process that I described to you, Mike, was from a help file, but it is spelled out in our registration agreement as well.
That's why you get my business, James. You.
Okay, five is, does what you do depend on whether it's renew or auto-renew with the registry? And based on the discussions we've had to date, do you still, Michael, believe we need to pursue that?
I don't see any harm in asking the question. Again, what we have heard from the responsible registrars that have been participating in the call, they say that there's no distinction. You know, I don't see any reason, if it's only going to take 20 seconds to ask the question, why not ask it to see whether...
Okay. Number six, does the registrar or any affiliate offer any value-added services regarding the sale auction of domains after their date of original expiration? Can you define what that means by calling them value-added services?
Well, I mean, I think what we would be looking at here is there are some registrars that may aggregate their expired names to a third party, whether that's, what is it, Network Solutions and Enom, I believe, what they use NameJet, I believe. There are other people that may have their own, if you will, in-house auction service providers. You know, the question is, that's kind of what I was looking at, is to see whether in the different variants, are the variants in regarding this practice dependent upon different value-added aftermarket services that registrar may or may not be offering.
Okay. I took the expression value-added services as value-added services to the original to the RAE. You're not using it in that form, in that meaning, though.
It depends, because there are some registrars that give a proceeds of the auction back to the original registrar.
That you're asking about in a separate question.
Okay. And again, it's been about 3 weeks since I've looked at these questions. But yes, I I'm just trying to ask different flavored questions. Some, again, may overlap, but to get broad brushstrokes of what is going on in identifying the different variant practices in the marketplace.
I suspect that's this is going to come out in relation to the questions 1 and 2.
But as a good attorney always does, you always ask a follow-up question. Sorry. James, you could appreciate it, James. And it's kind of like in the deposition. You ask the same question a couple of different times
I understand the concept. I don't think we're trying to annoy people too much here, though.
In the deposition, you have to answer, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
In this case, you don't. my inclination is to omit number 6 for the moment, unless we really feel it adds something into the equation. I mean, to the extent, do we really care whether it's an in-house auction service or one done at arm's length?
Well, I guess the reason I think the question has to be answered is we don't know whether that question will show a different trend in different variant practices. So, again, we're asking questions here. We're kind of what staff's going to do is they're going to ask the questions. They're then going to sit back and identify trends in the marketplace.
And the question I'm asking is why does it matter?
I don't know if it does or it doesn't. Yet. It could be. Let's just suppose, hypothetically, consider the following, that there's a certain registrar or a cluster of registrars who have an in-house auction service, right, that generally only give 5 days before they put the name up to auction, and the registrant has no means of recovering it after it has exceeded that 5-day practice, as opposed to another cluster that allows the auction to run during the 45-day period, during which that 45-day period or up to the 44th day, a registrant could come back and say, I want the name. I've spoken with at least one person who deals in the aftermarket who have said in a number of instances they were actively bidding on a name. They were notified that, yes, you had won, and then they were recontacted by the auction provider to say, I'm sorry, but as per the terms of your original contract, the original registrant has resurfaced and has renewed the name.
Right.
That's a good practice. I think what we need to do is look at these different variant practices to see what's good and that's just the reason.
Michael, I'm not arguing with any of that. The question is, why would that not have surfaced in answer to question 2? Asking about what is the sequence of events that happens post-expiration.
I guess I don't see the harm in repeating the question because so what happens is in post-expiration, you may have someone that just says, this is what happens day zero.
Can we have a consensus on the call of do we leave it in or not? I'm just wary of making this too long a process and people are not going to participate. James?
I don't see it as asking something that's a whole lot different than question 2, but neither do I think that we're going to get a whole lot of different responses. If someone is open and honest to question, no response to question 2, they'll just say IBID for question 6, and if they're reverse, I don't think we're going to catch them in a trap if they omitted something in question 2. So I think it's possibly overkill, just my opinion.
Barry?
Ms. Berry, I'd just say that, it would be great information to know, and I think at this point we don't know what is the good or the bad as a result of it, but hopefully it can get flushed out in number 2. But I think the...
Your inclination is to leave it in then.
Well, I'm hoping that it can get flushed out in 2. I think that having it stand alone in question 6 would definitely probably put off people from answering it.
But let me, Alan, this is James.
Yep.
And Mike, I know this is a good list of questions, but I know it's been a while since you've looked at them. But, on second look, perhaps there's a way to expand or modify question 2 in such a way that it encompasses what you're trying to get at in 6, 7, and 8. Maybe not 8. You know what I'm saying, though?
Well, that you've just said in a different way what I think I was trying to say, that I think we need to rework 2 into a way that it can be answered easily without long narratives, and I think implicitly that's going to flush out the answers to questions like 6. If it doesn't, we haven't done a very good job of it.
Marika, can I ask you? Yes,
please.
Because my suggestion would be, because, I mean, looking at these questions, and as I said, you know, having looked at some of the registrar's websites, I mean, I think a lot of this information is there. And indeed, before, you know, getting people on the phone and taking them through a list of 20 questions, or would it be an idea as well to, you know, work through these questions within this group, you know, for providing, like, the information that we can find online and seeing what's available there, and then identify which are those questions that we weren't able to find from the publicly available information that will be really vital to understand the process, and take those questions then back to the registrar in question and get those answered. Because, you know, a lot of this information, I think, is publicly available, at least in, you know, the agreement or in the policies on the website. So, you know, it might make sense to save the time we might get from registrars or the responsiveness we might get to save for those questions that, you know, we cannot find the information to.
You're saying leave it in for now, but possibly after we do our first survey of documents on the web, we may decide it's not needed anymore.
Yeah, because, I mean, my idea would be that that information comes out indeed on the question 2 if we make it extensive and capture there all the information. And I think it might make sense for the group then to look at what information we can find by just looking at the different policies and agreements, and then come back saying, oh, well, you know, the one question we really need to ask all the registrars, because it's not obvious from the data, you know, available, is this question. And that's what we take back and call people, because I can see that people don't want to go through a list of 20 questions if, you know, they keep on describing the same kind of thing. And, I mean,
okay,
they might refer, as James said, Eden, but...
Okay, let's leave it in for the moment, but subject to deletion if it's not required based on what we do as the next couple of steps. Number 7 is, are there revenue sharing if it's sold? I think that's a valid question.
If it's expired? Ooh.
Hello?
Yeah, it's James. I was just making light of the situation. That's the question. That's fine.
There are some registrars who have done this in the past and perhaps are still doing it. I'm not sure what the how pervasive this is.
Poor attempt at humor in an effort to liven
the Okay, humor. Sorry. Some registrars are more generous than others. Does the registrar or affiliate provide the registrant prior to expiration the right to remove the name from this value-added service offering?
Yes, if they renew.
I'll take that as humor.
That is good humor, James, but it's actually very accurate. Fair point. There you go. Touché.
You're really, Michael, I think what you were asking is if the registrar by default says, I will sell your domain name after a certain amount of time or try to sell it, do they allow the registrant to say, no, you won't?
Yeah, I was just asking the question to see whether they said, no, you know, I want that to go back to the registry, or whether a registrar would say, well, you know, I understand what you want to do, but I'm now going to take possession of this. I think it goes to sort of the insight of, you know, how a registrar is treating a domain name. Is it a service that is to the benefit of the original registrant, or does the registrar have the ability at anywhere during the life of that registrar to sort of step in and say, well, I'm now going to take over some of the rights associated with this name? That's kind of what I was trying to, you know, ask the question to gain some insight into. Perhaps overkill, and again, I would defer to Marika, if in fact they are getting substantially detailed answers in the first part, this is something that perhaps could be deleted or skipped over.
Okay, let's put that in that category and go on.
Well, I do have a quick question here for the legal lines on the group, and I think that's Mike and Ellen. I'm actually not familiar enough with your background. I don't know if you're a lawyer or not. The question is relative to an extension of rights beyond a term of an agreement. And I think, you know, I've heard this called like dead hand or something like that in probate type stuff. But I guess my question, Mike, is, you know, if I were to, trade in a car at a dealership, or better yet, I would to reach the end of a lease of a car, and I would tell the dealer, I'm giving this back to you. I've reached my end of my lease, but please don't resell it to Mike Collage. I mean, what is my standing as the former party to that agreement to then determine what, how it's handled going forward?
Well, is your hypothetical done?
Well, mostly. I mean, I think that it's a binary choice at that point where you just say, you can reassume possession of it under these mechanisms, or you can relinquish it. You do not have the option to relinquish it and then dictate how we disposition it. Does that make sense?
No, it makes total sense. And I think the way I would try to approach that is, this gets back to the registry contract as well as the registry-registrar agreement. When you look at a domain name registration, you, the registrar, are sponsoring a name on behalf of a registrant at the registry. So that's the flow. It's the registrar goes to the registry and does something on behalf of a registrant, and there needs to be reasonable expectations of payment and all that stuff. So the question I'm asking is, when the registrar or the registrant has said the lease is up, does that name not then need, you know, does the registrar say, well, I'm going to step in before I turn it back to the registry, like the original contract, you know, the original privity of contract that went registrar or registrant, registrar, registry. I think we need to look at what happens in that legal limbo when the registrant says, I don't want it, but the registrar is saying, well, I might do something before I give this car back to General Motors. I, the dealership, might try to find somebody. Do the contracts allow that?
Yeah. Okay.
Well, yeah, Alan, if I could answer Mike's question,
sure.
Please. I would say that, you know, take a look at the language in our agreement. What it says is essentially that on the date of expiration, we're going to renew this on your behalf and give you a certain amount of time, you know. So I think that the answer is, we're doing this on behalf of, you know, you have the right to reimburse us for that cost. The registries, from their perspective, all the names are renewing, okay? It's just that some of them will be, some of them the charges will stick, and some of them will either be refunded or will cancel before the charge applies. So I think from the registry's perspective, it's not a question of we need to give it back because it's not ours anymore. I think it's more of a question of, we are holding this for someone to give them an opportunity to return it, and we are also, you know, making it available to others as well. From the registry perspective,
and I think you hit on something right there. Is you, the registrar, are now making the domain name offered or making it available to others? So, I think this is an important distinction. Is the registrar during this limbo period almost acting as a quasi-registry regarding the allocation of names? Because when you look at the registry agreement, it talks about how the allocation of names is something that potentially falls within consensus policy. And I think that's kind of what we're looking at here is, you know, I think this question needs to be asked from a legal standpoint. I really do.
I mean,
you may disagree,
if I may get in, please. We are looking at what data to collect. We are not here to debate whether the registrant has the right to get it back after the contract expires, after the automobile lease expires. Domain names are not traditional goods, and if you look at the ICANN, the history with the EDDP, with the redemption grace period, with statements by ICANN saying a registrant after expiration has the right to change the registrar, it is clearly not traditional goods, and there are rights that have been acquired de facto, and that's the the overall environment in which we're working. So I don't think it's us for us to debate whether there are whether the original the RAE has rights post expiration. I think de facto they do. Now, if someone wants to make the case that they don't and we should change all of that, those practices associated with what happens after expiration, that's a different game than what we're looking at. It would override it, no doubt, but it's not one that we're embarking on in this discussion.
And my point being, again, that registration has one registrant at a time, and by allowing rights to extend beyond that registration agreement is an infringement upon the rights of the current registrant. We don't have to go into that.
Yeah, and it may be an interesting discussion, but I don't think it's the one that we can have right now.
Okay.
Certainly not during data collection.
Certainly not in data collection, right.
Does anyone...
I would agree.
Sorry, was someone trying to say something else?
I was just agreeing with you, Alan, so
okay.
We can move forward.
Okay. Number 9 is one of the contentious ones, and the question is, what is the price that is charged to recover during the RGP? I would suggest that we don't need to know the absolute price.
Fair enough, Alan. Can I offer a friendly amendment based upon some of the
I was going
critique?
To, but we'll give you a chance first.
To me, I think there's three buckets. Is it under 50? Is it between 50 and 100? Or is it over 100? And with those three buckets, we generally have an idea as to what the registrant's going to be paying. So if we could have three buckets where this financial cost to registrants, you know, it's one of those three buckets, I think, is probably a reasonable breakdown and the variant pricing of what you may see in the marketplace.
Comment from James or Barry?
Yeah, this is James. I would alter a friendly amendment, which is to say, is the price displayed publicly on your website, and if so, please point it out.
Okay.
And I was going to suggest, instead of specific price points, is do you mark up the registry cost, yes or no? And we can add in James's question onto that.
This is Marika, because I think James's question is answered by the audit that was done by the compliance team that will be published shortly. So they found, I mean, that we when we discussed on Tuesday, that a number of registrars do post that they have a fee, but they actually don't state what the fee is. So, and that there's going to be an advisory explaining that they should state what the fee actually is. So
right,
redo that here.
Any registrar who answers no to this says they're not in compliance with the contract.
Indeed.
How many are going to answer no? they may be, but... So I think the only price point is an issue of the amount, and I feel uncomfortable starting to put dollar numbers on it, but I don't feel uncomfortable asking do you mark it up or not, and I believe there are some registrars who mark it up and some who don't.
My question is actually, because what information do you think that will give to the group, you know, looking at the questions we're asking? I'm not really sure what the answer to this question will...
Excellent question. Michael?
Well, I think what happens is I've just agreed that we're not going to be looking at price. What we're going to be looking for is there some place that they can point us to on their website where they disclose the specific price to the end registrant,
And Marika has said it's a contractual requirement they do, not that they make it easy to find, but that it be there.
Yeah, and the compliance team is looking into that one, you know, as William shared on the mailing list. So I'm not really sure whether we need to cover that here as it's currently being dealt with, I think, as we speak.
As I said, in light of William's good work before, we can take this out in the spirit of making your job easier since some of your other colleagues are looking at this issue.
Finally.
So, no problem.
Finally, we have a deletion. Okay, number 10. What is the cost prior to the RGP? Again, I would feel very uncomfortable asking the cost. I would suggest that we ask a number of specific questions about the cost. Specifically, is it the same as the renewal would have been pre-expiration? if it's more, how does it vary with time or vary by with the perceived value of the domain?
Alan, again, and I'll go to staff, Margie and Marika, since they may be conducting this. You know, if the work that the compliance team is doing, do you think that they'll potentially get to some of these pricing issues where you perhaps can just flip through the pages that hopefully they'll be updating to get a feel for where these potential, you know, different variants or price buckets are? Again, I am sensitive to some of the valid concerns that the registrars do have, if we could avoid some questions that deal with cost by instead just directly going to the website and sort of gleaning some data that way. Do you think that's an approach that is possible? I'm just asking staff that's probably going to be tasked with undertaking this whether this helps or hurts their information data gathering efforts.
I think the issue might be that this is not a requirement under the RIA or the EDDP to have posted on the website. I mean, I think we definitely can take it in if we're looking through the website and they do post what the cost is. I don't think it's an issue, but I don't think there's any requirement to have that information publicly posted.
No, are you talking about, I thought that there is a requirement to have the price posted, but there's no requirement as to what the price should be, and in fact the RAA says that pricing is off, you know, isn't, I think it says, I might have to look at it, that you can't have requirements that relate to price.
I don't think the RAA talks about the price that it will be charged for reclaiming it post-expiration. I don't believe it.
I think it discusses it for the RGP.
Yeah, no. But RGP was the previous question.
But
this
not
one now
in
is
the
prior
ARGP.
To RGP.
Yes, not in the ARGP.
Sorry, yeah, I was focusing on the other one. But the RAA does say that the outside of scope of consensus policies are policies that prescribe or limit the price of registrar services. So that
and nor are we trying to set one, at least not so far.
Not so far anyway. Okay. So the idea of finding the price would be to do what?
Well, the issue is predictability, and if a registrar says the price is not specified and it varies, and it may vary based on time, there are some registrars who reportedly slowly ramp up the price as time goes on. So if you wait a month, it costs you more than if you waited a day. Other registrars are based on the semantic analysis of the name or based on the results of the monetization of the pay-per-clip page they put up may vary the price. In other words, they know they're going to be able to get $10,000 at auction. Why would they give it back to you for $9.95? And we know these practices vary widely.
Right.
And that's really the question, is transparency and predictability.
You can't say
it's predictable if the registrar says, I have a magic formula that I'll apply dynamically and tell you after the fact what the price is going to be. That I wouldn't class as being predictable.
Right. I see that as a different question. So you're not asking what the cost is, but you're asking how you inform the registrar on the cost.
Well, I suggested instead of the what is the cost question of asking essentially what are the parameters that contribute to the cost, which means it is fixed, it is variable, it's fixed at the normal price, or it's marked up above the normal price. Do any of the registrars find that offensive? In the absence of...
I'm listening. I'm taking that all in. So let's just keep moving here.
Okay.
Sorry, to answer the question, I don't think what the compliance team is looking at would be this topic.
No, I think the compliance team was only looking at RGP issues. RGP, right.
Right. And I think, you know, can I just speak in generalities that, you know, for a marketplace to function, consumers have to have informed choices, and they have to know what the pricing is ahead of time and all that stuff. So that's fine.
Okay.
Now, so they also should know that, you know, something could be going to an auction system where the price is undefined, but, you know, they have a fair and equitable, you know, participation opportunity to participate. So we'll just leave it at that.
That's your desired outcome. We'll deal with that later. We're trying to find out right now is what is the practice. Okay, number 11. Aside from these two recovery renewal windows, does the registrar impose any fees on the registrant other than a regular renewal price to renew re-register the domain name? I think we've already covered that now.
Yeah, I think that is...
Michael, you agree?
No objections, yeah.
Okay, gone. 12. Does the registrar affiliate provide the registrant with the ability to renew register a domain name once it has entered an auction process or after the completion of the auction, I would add? Again, I would put a question mark beside this one saying I hope that's going to be covered in the question two, but if not, we need to make sure it is or ask it separately. Is there agreement on that?
I think that's the prudent. I would say that's the prudent approach.
Okay.
And again, we would defer to staff. You know, they're going to have their feet on the ground conducting it. They'll quickly probably gain a feel for how this flows after they do a small handful of registrars. So,
I'm going to propose something at the end, which addresses how we get there, because I'm a little bit concerned about that.
You know, Alan, this is James. I'm a little conflicted about this particular one because on the one hand, I want to make sure that, you know, if a registrar is allowing the RAE to recover a name even while it is currently under auction, I think that should be highlighted. You know, that's an extension of an opportunity to recover a name, right?
Right, but I hope it will be covered. If we extract the information for question one and two properly, I think that's going to be included in this.
Okay, and then
if it turns out it isn't, then we want to be able to ask that question.
Yeah, let's just make sure that the registrars who are doing this are able to distinguish themselves in those questions. That's all.
Indeed. Well, I'll give as an anecdote when I was speaking at the very beginning of this process to Two Cows. And they gave the example of a domain name that had expired, was taken over within their own portfolio, but officially transferred. And the guy came in 6 months later saying, I was in a coma with a brain tumor. Can I have it back, please? And since it was in their own portfolio, they gave it back. So there will always be interesting examples at the extreme. And I think someone who's come through a six-month coma deserves to get their domain back. where are we now? Okay, 13. Are participants in registrar or affiliates auction apprised of the registrant's rights to renew a domain name after the auction? Do we care? If the participants in the auction are informed? What we really care about is the previous question of does the RAE have the right to get it back?
Yeah, I would submit how an auction is conducted is certainly beyond the scope of not only
if a registrar wants to mistreat their bidders, they can do that. That's not our domain. Excuse the pun. Michael?
No, as I said. No objection there. The only reason I added that question was in talking with some different people that have tried to obtain domains through auctions was the story that on numerous occasions they had won an auction but then found out that because a registrar came forward that, you know, they weren't entitled to it. So what I found interesting in that feedback from the people I spoke with was that perhaps this is a metric that we can identify as to how many times are registrants coming forward in doing this. But again, I agree. This question appears to be towards the bidder, out of scope. Let's move on.
Yeah. I mean, from the point of view of our scope, the fact that someone got a domain name back after it, the auction had started or ended, is good news.
I would agree. So, as I said, I think it is good news. We can move on.
Now, as soon as ICANN starts regulating the auctions, then this becomes a relevant question. No one's going to scream when I said that?
I have a mute button.
Okay.
And I kind of gave up after their budget exceeded $40 million a year, so anything's possible.
For those registrars or their affiliates that provide auction services with the ability of the registrant to renew, re-register, or name, excuse me, what number of registrants have exercised that right? I think there's a more general question that we want to get at, and that is of people who let their domain expire, what fraction come back after the fact and want it back? And a further question of what fraction of those actually get it back?
Yeah, and I would add the qualifier before the end of the ARGP.
Yes, within a reasonable time frame.
So before the end of the ARGP.
What is the ARGP?
The auto-renew grace period of 45 days after it expires.
Okay, fine.
I would take that as a friendly, I have no problem with those friendly amendments.
Okay. 15, what percentage of the overall GTLD market does the registrar responding to this question represent? That's a number that ICANN can assign unilaterally without asking the registrar.
Now, my question is, if this is linked to the others, other questions, then there goes the sanitization or the anonymity behind the responses.
I think
if I can, Alan, real quick, I am not passionate about this. The only reason I was originally trying to ask this when this was more of a voluntary questionnaire as opposed to a survey staff that was a survey that staff would be undertaking was I just wanted to get going back to that 80-20. You know, is this, are the people responding, do they represent 80% of the market or is it more of the 20%? That's I respect the anonymity and open to friendly suggestions.
I would say we are interested in a global percentage of when we have the whole picture, what percentage of the market are we talking about?
See, I like that approach, Alan, where we say that of those that responded, you know, respondents totaled X percent of the global GTLD market.
Now, I mean, clearly, given that, in our call the other day, I think we heard that Enum has about 30,000 resellers and GoDaddy has about 30,000 resellers. Clearly, we're not looking at all of the market here.
Well,
but the question is, are we ending up getting, and what percentage are we getting?
Yeah, market share is not delineated by resellers.
Well, no, it
isn't. Market share is, okay.
But based on the model of the registrar, their resellers may be going along with all of the answers that the registrar gave and may not be. Certainly, I don't know about GoDaddy. I know Enom has resellers that, what's the expression that Jeff used? Essentially, the reseller does not want to be affiliated with Enom, and they have their own set of rules and their own image, which may or may not coincide with the domains that Enom sells directly.
Well, and again, relationship and branding is one thing, but you know, when it comes to compliance with policy, it doesn't matter who the registrar is; they better keep their resellers, informed and operating within the parameters that they're going to have to be answerable to ICANN.
Well,
right.
But indeed, we are talking about things that aren't within the domain of current policy and trying to decide if we need to write policy in this area. So things that are outside of the current policy but are simply business practices are not necessarily things that are registrar enforces from its resellers. I mean, they might. That's part of their the business relationship they have with the reseller.
I don't know.
So all I'm saying is whatever percentage we get, it's still going to be fuzzy. But I think the global percentage is as much as we can do without starting to make information available that we don't want analyzed by someone.
Yeah, and I would once again just submit that all of the resellers on planet Earth have zero market share from perspective of GTLD management.
Say that again.
All of the resellers, ultimately, it's the registrar. The parent registrar that's responsible.
Indeed.
That has management responsibilities of those registrations.
I don't think anyone's questioning that. But the whole process of what happens post-expiration is not necessarily following a process that is enforced by the registrar, other than, the parts that are currently regulated. Okay. We finished the questions. Is there anyone else who has anything they want to add that was not included in these that we feel should be somewhere in the list? No? Okay. I would suggest that as the next step, I'm going to put Marika on the spot because I haven't said this to her before, that over the next few days, but prior to the next meeting, we try to come up with a rewording of questions 1 and 2, which makes it easier to extract the information we want, less qualitative and more quantitative. If that's agreeable with the group and with Marika, then we can try to do that. I don't know how successful we'll be.
But Alan, your question is whether I can have a first go at that?
No, I suggested that the two of us together try to have a first go at it and present something in time. I'm not sure if we present it to this group or to the whole group, but effectively in time for next Tuesday's meeting. Do you have a bit of time in between now and then to for us to talk about it, or?
Yeah, I'm happy to.
Send some things back and forth.
I'm happy to make a first draft like tomorrow morning my time based on the discussion and send that back to you.
I'm saying this knowing that it's 10 o'clock in the evening right now your time.
So I can work with you and get you a first draft and
then
work from.
Okay, let's talk tomorrow and figure out how to do that. But if the rest of the group agrees, I think we're going to we have to assign, someone to do a straw man for 1-2, and I'm willing to take it on at this point with Marika, if that's okay with the rest of you.
Fine,
no problem.
Okay. All right, then.
Thanks, everybody.
Let's try. The intent is to try to have a revised version of this annotated by next week. Do we want to try to meet again before we present this to the whole group, or do we want to simply send it to the whole group and see what their reaction is? They won't have much. They won't have had much time to look at it prior to the meeting, of course.
Right. I think, bearing that in mind, then maybe if we can just, if everyone approves on the list, we can just post it to the larger group, and if there are issues that we need to discuss on the list, then we would hold off and have another call.
Okay. So
just suggesting that as a path forward.
So you're suggesting we try to have it ready for Monday to send out to this group?
I mean, if it's
only
to the list,
only chops one day off of three, so.
Next, we have a call next Tuesday. Is that correct?
There is a Pedner call next Tuesday. Yes.
There is.
Yeah. We had decided to have them weekly unless they're
right.
canceled.
Right. So I don't know if that's enough time either to prepare, review, approve, and then to disseminate that and have it to digest it on the list. That's just my personal
opinion. I'm just worried about having yet another meeting where we continually say we can't talk about this until we know what we're doing with data collection. Maybe we need to cancel next week, Tuesday's meeting because of that. Let's let Marika and I have a go at it for a few days and see if we think we'll have something to both bounce off this group and, in fact, to bounce off the larger group.
Can I add another question?
Marika, you don't have to ask.
Okay.
You don't have to ask whether you can ask. You can just ask.
Okay, because my question is, are we already going to discuss as well, like, how many registrars are we going to target with this survey? Because, of course, I understand there's a desire to get data quickly, but, of course, there's as well the reality of a lot of other working groups going on and, you know, this, of course, taking time in researching the data and finding it on websites and then maybe calling people and things like that. So do we already have any idea of how many are we going to target or which ones or how we're going to go about that?
Well, you asked a similar question or somebody asked a similar question during one of the full meetings, and I think the example you gave is if you're going to want 200, it's going to take a long time. I could say categorically I don't expect anywhere near 200. I would say if we pick them carefully and do 20, we're doing fine. But any other comments?
How do we pick?
I don't know.
Random selection?
Just don't pick us.
Well, we pick the ones who are on our working group.
Actually, James, I would like to pick you because you have great information readily available on your website. It makes my life a lot easier.
I don't think we can avoid picking the very largest of the registrars.
I thought we could, you know, duck down and hide in the corner.
Flip through unnoticed.
The back of the room and sneak out without anyone noticing.
If a registrar has two people on the working group, then they're the first one we ask for.
There's a couple of registrars like that, right? Or is it just us again?
No, I think it's just you, but maybe not.
Okay.
Well, maybe it's something as well for the bigger group to discuss or decide how they would like to go about that.
Well, how do people react to my statement that 20 is a good start? Is that too high or too low?
Well, I think in number of total registrars, it's low. But in the terms of market share, if you took the top 20, you'd probably cover its swath of the QTLB market. And again, all of this is assuming you get some response besides a page full of no comments.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing stopping us from saying 20 when we get the data for 20 that we need more. But the question is, I don't want to assign too large a number and then find out the task was really onerous and we never get the answers.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's a reasonable start.
Marika, what do you feel is a reasonable number based on workload to get some answers out moderately quickly?
It depends how you define moderately quickly.
Well, our standard by next Monday.
well,
no, that was
impossible.
That was a joke.
I mean, yeah, it all depends a bit because, you know, as I said, for some registrars, I noted that the information is very readily available, and for some it will take some digging. So,
if this is going to take a month and a half, we're talking about Seoul before we get any data to start the discussions.
No, I don't think it will be that long.
And that would bother me significantly.
You know, I hope it won't take that long.
Okay. I mean, if we're talking 2 weeks, to some extent, I'll say how many can you think you, once we come up with the questions, the question for you perhaps is how many can you get done in 2 weeks? And maybe that's the way to get to the answer.
Now this is
James. Have a go and see how far I get after 2 weeks.
Yeah. Sorry, someone else is trying to talk.
Yeah, this is James and Alan. I just wanted to point out if you wanted to make staff's work even easier, you could probably cut it off at the top 10 and still get a very, very sizable, you know, there's a pretty big drop-off after that, just in terms of GTLD market share.
I think I can live with that.
I'm just trying to help.
Okay.
So
it might be
as well that we first do the top 10 and then see what kind of data we get back. I mean, if we really see that, you know, there's a lot of discrepancies or we see, well,
they're all doing the same thing, is it worth indeed looking for it or not? Maybe that's a way as well.
We're talking about numbers you can count on your fingers and your toes for the first go around anyway. So
I have a 20 swipe to work.
Sorry, did I miss that?
I said, but 20 is twice the work.
Indeed.
Yeah.
I don't think we need to set a number right now, but we're not talking huge numbers for the first pass in any case.
Okay.
Does that give you a level of comfort, Marisa?
It does.
Good.
Thank you.
Glad we can be of service. We have spent over an hour and a half. Is there anything else we need to do?
Go to sleep.
That's me.
Oh, okay. It's permission for me to...
my permission to just...
Michael, we'd like an email reporting on Lobstergate.
I will do that. Thanks again, everybody, for
okay.
being so confident. Have a good one.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Thanks. Bye.